Hello and welcome to another episode of the Challenger Cities podcast with me, Ian Montgomery. And I love the guest that I've got for you this time. So this is Mary Rowe and she heads up the Canadian Urban Institute. Now, Mary is not a lady who holds back on an opinion. I went to an amazing event hosted by her in Ottawa in December 2024. And it gave me loads and loads of hope for the future for Canadian cities, big and small across the country. We made this as a thing that has started in Toronto and broadened out as I've moved away, but I still care about Toronto and Mary lives in Toronto and she clearly cares about it. But I also think it's important to think about smaller places, smaller neighborhoods, smaller cities. And a lot of this conversation is talking about localism and starting small. We could have gone on for a while. We had a few tech difficulties when we set this up. So if the sound quality isn't quite there, my apologies. Hopefully it works okay. And I suspect we're going to have to get Mary back to do more here. So without further ado, let's get right into it. Here is a fantastic conversation with Mary Rowe from the Canadian Urban Institute. But yeah, Mary, thanks for taking the time to have a chat with me. And I know we just dealt with a lot of technical headache. So
No, I'm delighted. But you know that expression about Mercury being retrograde?
Yeah.
You know, it's some zodiacal thing about when mechanical things start to happen and things start, you know, it's the same thing when you say things happen in threes or I feel like early January, we just cut ourselves a lot of slack. Mercury is retrograde. Things come in threes. We're all kind of just trying to get ourselves back into gear. I'm trying to think of a time. No, our memories are restricted here, but a time of such sort of cascading uncertainty. You know, I was talking with a guy in the coffee shop yesterday, and we were both sort of talking about how we want to abandon the news and how it's just full of rhetoric and conjecture and animosity. And then on top of that, now we've got wildfires in California that people are fleeing. And then all the global disturbance we have around peace and security. And you just think, God, why don't I just put my head under the pillow and keep reading? So anyway, I'm happy to talk with you about something that we both care about, which is local places.
You give me a ton of hope. You give me so much hope. So I got to know you through going to your event in Ottawa the back end of last year, but everyone's miserable right now. Everyone's complaining about something. The world's literally on fire, and then we have Donald creeping into the shadows and Elon rage tweeting at all hours of the day. You give me reasons to be optimistic because Canadians seem to be finally giving a shit about cities.
And what I would say is what gives me optimism, what I said to the guy in the coffee shop as we were standing at the counter and the folks that had just made us these beautiful coffees, which I'm very appreciative of. I took one sip and thought, life is worth living again. And what the four of us were agreeing was that, you know, when you're overwhelmed by these events that seem insurmountable and distant, you know, out of which, you know, we have very little agency or control, the best antidote to that is to focus back hyper-local on the areas where you actually have some agency, where you have some engagement with people, and where you can make a difference. And if that means me paying more attention to my immediate neighborhood, to where I'm spending my dollars, who I'm conversing with, am I paying attention when I walk the street to see what conditions are? I think this may be a moment where hyperlocalization is a more, not just an important thing to do, but it may in fact be a more reassuring and literally a grounding thing to do to remind us that when it really comes down to it, what matters is how we relate to our neighbors and ensuring that we have the kind of conditions so that we can make the lives we want to make for each other and for ourselves.
So if we go back a bit, let's start with you. How did you become this person that is so important for urbanism in Canada?
Oh my God, what a nice sweet thing for you to say. Well, I don't know if I'm important to urbanism, but here's what I would say. I grew up in a place. I grew up in a neighborhood. I had all the, in a small community in Southern Ontario, London, and I had all the benefits of that neighborhood. And, you know, at the time, I don't know what we called it, really. We called it our street, actually. I actually did have a relationship to the street, even as a kid. And my friends we all lived on the same street, a few houses down from each other. We all went to the same elementary and high schools, and then university, of course, we dispersed. But there was a street life for me as a kid. We had sidewalks. We had backyard rinks. We had a backyard pool. We didn't, but our neighbors did. We had a neighborhood church. We had a neighborhood variety store. We had a neighborhood butcher. We walked everywhere and rode bicycles everywhere. So it was a little idyllic in that way. I mean, I don't want to overly nostalgicize. How do you like that? I tried to create a verb there, but I don't want to do that because it's not everybody is in this circumstance at all. But what's interesting to me, I guess, is that at an early age, I became aware of neighbors and I became aware of the tactile nature of life, that you get out and you do stuff. My father was a gardener. You know, there was an engagement with the outside, with the outdoors. And then I became very athletic in my teens and 20s. And what's interesting about that is that was by virtue of neighborhood engagement, because a pal of mine in elementary school really changed my life, said, we did not come from a family that went to camps. We didn't have a cottage. And so the summers were kind of, make your own fun. And I had a neighbor kid who said, oh, you know what? There's a program being offered by the city, by what was called the Public Utilities Commission at the time, at a local park. We should check it out. And we would have been in around grade 5 or 6. So what are we? We're 10 or 11. And we started going to this park. And they had a paid recreation supervisor there whose job was to arrive every morning and put a program together. And that was everything from craft to learning sports to field trips to all sorts of stuff. That was life-changing for me because the opportunity to engage with folks, we walked there, we met kids from different schools. We then competed in baseball and various sports with parks across the city. We would go on the bus. We'd go to another part of the city, which I would never get to, and we would play baseball and all that kind of stuff. And so I think when I look back on it, I'm still friends with that gang of gals that did that and guys that did that. That had a real impact on me in terms of wedding me to adjacency, to proximity, to publicly supported programming. And did I think much about what that would look like vocationally? No. I took a geography class in high school, and I often think about that teacher because he introduced us to a spatial awareness of how cities were actually and how communities are actually structured. But I didn't go into a career in this at all. I went into political science. I worked. I was a sort of sporadic student. I took breaks between university and high school, and then I took a break in the middle of high school and blah, blah, blah. And then I took a break after university and I went back to sports and was a referee for basketball for a couple of years because there were no jobs when I first graduated. So I've had a very odd, kind of not very predictable career. I remember one of my high school friends, 10 years in, we had dinner, a group of us, and he said to me, he was an engineer, and so were the others, I think. He just turned to me, he said, Mary, why aren't you like the rest of us? Why don't you just like your job, And I'd never had a regular job, but I started to be interested in how do you create collaborative solutions to public challenges at a very community-based level. When I was in high school, I dreamt up this thing that we should get high school musicians to go into long-term care facilities. That was because a neighbor on my street, one of the dads, came to me and said, you guys have got all these skills and we've got an aunt who's in a care facility. Why don't you come and play your instruments for them? And I thought, well, that's a good idea. So we created a whole program around it. So I had an instinct early that you could concoct these kinds of collaborations, whatever they look like, and then people would pull out of them. And then somehow, honestly, I don't know, Ian, how these things happen. When people say, talk to me about your career, I think, well, my career has been a series of opportunities that I was able to say yes to. And when I look back on it, I can see there's a through line around connection, community, resourceful approaches to shared challenges, not leading it to being just one sector. Oh, that's a business issue, or that's a community issue, or that's a government issue, that they're all shared and that they're grounded in some kind of local reality, which is the intervention point where you should start. So I have a bit of an aversion to big macro solutions. I've spent time in government and I have to tolerate those kinds of instincts that people have to kind of come up with big grand solutions that are going to solve problems for good, once and for all, we're going to solve something. And you sort of do your best to contribute usefully to those kinds of conversations. But it's not really my orientation. My orientation is much more look at the granular, talk with people locally who are trying different things. And then if you find things that work, then you start thinking about how we amplify that so that it could be mimicked or copied or replicated or adjusted in other kinds of environments. So I'm a ground up person. It started early, and it's kind of one of those things that once you realize that's who you are, you can't change it.
And I saw that
at the event in December, you kind of had this quite an eclectic collection of people and an eclectic collection of topics. And it felt very much like community relationship driven of this is a really important conversation we're having, but it wasn't just the sort of talk for talk's sake. It should be very Ottawa, and we were sort of, we'll come to Ottawa later. But you did this thing of people sort of recognizing that problem isn't very simple, but we can connect the dots here. And if we start going in that direction, we probably don't solve the whole thing, but we at least create some momentum behind it.
I mean, this is the tension we had with public policy, because let's take universal daycare. You know, that took a big, big commitment and a strong aspirational belief in what that would do for communities, for families, and for the economy. And you need that kind of bold ambition and that large, broad brush. We're going to find a way to do this at a scale that's going to matter. But when it rolls out, then you realize, well, you know what? Actually, you can't have the same sets of rules for rural Newfoundland that you've got for downtown Winnipeg. And so it's a conundrum, because you want it, same with climate change, all these large challenges that we have, wealth creation, economic opportunity, all these things, equity, they're all strong, off rights-based, aspirational commitments that you want to make as a country, which I think is why these strange provocations coming from President-elect Trump are so jarring, because it's underestimating just how difficult it is to create a kind of consistent approach to quality of life in a country as vast as Canada with only 40 million people. And the challenge that the Americans have is a equally geographically vast country with 400 million. It's really hard to do this. And the only, I think, viable way to do it is to do a bunch of pilots and tests at much more local scales, and then try to find a way then to get resources allocated so that you don't have that kind of inconsistent patchwork where you can get childcare in one part of the country, but you can't in the other. The truth of it is that's true. You know, healthcare is, we have universal healthcare, but the extent to which it's delivered universally is very, very spotty. So maybe we just have to get real about this, but that's why you can hear, like, it quickly becomes overwhelming to me, and I'm back to, wait a sec, I'm going to go back to the main street. I'm going to go back to my neighborhood. I'm going to go back to the community in my, that I have some kind of direct engagement with. And then where I think an organization like the Urban Institute sits, is how do we create connective tissue then so that the best practice in Antigonish is actually known in Abbotsford, so that we don't waste as much time reinventing wheels that somebody else has tried, and that we're constantly tweaking and adapting and tweaking and adapting. But this puts me at loggerheads with lots and lots of my closest friends who are much more committed to really ambitious systems change. And so I think they probably internally roll their eyes and say, oh, Mary's there supporting, tinkering, and worry about the big change. So I try to hold my own in both worlds, but it's hard.
I find Canada really struggles with that, sort of the different ends of the spectrum. And the one I always come back to is like the King Street pilot in Toronto.
Yeah.
We love a pilot. We did it. It worked quite nicely.
Yeah.
But then we didn't do anything. We let it rot. And then we sort of brought it back, and we just sort of, the pilot is now the solution versus the bigger picture.
But, you know, the principle of a pilot is just to de-risk it.
Yeah.
So, for instance, another way to approach piloting is to say, let's work with smaller communities where they can try stuff and where the risk is somewhat mitigated, because in a couple of ways. One is that you can get it into smaller pieces. You can get into a smaller geography, hopefully, so that you try something, and instead of it putting, you know, causing a change for hundreds of thousands of people, it causes a change for a few. 10,000, and then you can adjust. But it also often is the case that it's just simpler. It's just, there are fewer layers of a bureaucracy to kind of wade through to try things. I think the fact that the King Street pilot happened at all is a miracle. And then now they're learning from it. But you know what I would also say, and I don't want to get too far into our conversation without getting this point across, which is something that I feel quite strongly about. I feel that I live in Toronto, as you know, but CUI is interested in cities of all scales and communities across the country. But what I notice certainly here, two things. One, there's just a fascination with complaining. And I always feel that's just part of the temperament. You know, you and I were talking a bit about it earlier. There's the cold weather, it's January, people complain. But I think some of this is a function of people not living anywhere else and being pretty provincial and parochial in their view, and then kind of complaining, not realizing, well, shit, man, if you lived anywhere else, you'd see Toronto's pretty darn good. But I also think this is something that I've been watching for the last, I came back to Toronto in late 2016. And so I've been here for, what is that, 8 years. And what I've watched is a kind of ambivalence about the kind of city we are becoming. And so my quick version of that is, if you live in New York City or in London or in Paris, nobody complains about the traffic. I mean, everybody, of course there's traffic. Of course there's traffic. And we have tons of construction activity, which we don't manage that well, obviously, here. And that's a problem. It needs to be fixed. But to spend a lot of time hand-wringing about this and suggesting it's some kind of gross mismanagement versus just acknowledging it's a city with a ton of activity. And you don't have that expectation in other global cities. You kind of are resigned to the fact that there's going to be, just like in New York, it took New York a long time to be able to do congestion pricing, but that's how long it takes for cities to come to terms with who they are. And I think that's partly, you hear it also in smaller communities across the country that had a boost of population growth after the pandemic. And they're now dealing with all these issues around, suddenly they have to wait in line for things and it's hard to get parking. And, you know, what used to be really easy is now more complicated. Well, it takes us a while to catch up with ourselves. And I think I'm interested, Challenger Cities as a concept is really interesting to me because it's trying to put people into a forward facing disposition that we are a work in progress. If everything was easy, we wouldn't be undergoing the remarkable change that we're experiencing. And that would be quite negative, I think. I want to say to people that struggle with that, maybe you should move to a city that is more static and isn't going to have the kind of dynamism that a global center like the Toronto region is.
Somebody messaged me about this last night saying they're Canadian, they'd worked in the UK. What they always use the phrase challenge the brief.
Yeah.
So they're like, push against what you've been asked for. And then when they came back to Canada, they were saying that they were sort of told to drop the challenge thing because it wasn't seen as push the boundaries. It was seen as you're disrupting authority. I found that really, really interesting around, like, it encouraged me to keep, like, this. There's a reason this thing is called Challenger Cities. But I think the thing I come back to with Canada is, when I was a kid, I always wanted to live in Canada. So I had my aunt, my uncle, my cousins lived in Edmonton, and they lived in Fort Mac and then Edmonton. So my introduction to Canada was Calgary, Edmonton, Fort Mac.
Uh-huh.
And then a lot of the work I did in Canada originally when I was living in the States was Calgary and Moncton, New Brunswick.
Right.
And I have a huge soft spot for Moncton, New Brunswick. It's not a particularly brilliant place, but the people there are phenomenal.
Right.
And you can walk down the street. I can walk down the street in Moncton having not been there for a while, and people will stop me and say hello and they remember who I am, and I didn't do anything terribly impressive there, despite the rumors. To me, like, those kinds of places, when I was working there, it was all about population decline, aging populations. And then since the pandemic, lots of people, I think Moncton is the second most popular place for new comedians to move to.
Yeah.
Change the city. And that gives me loads of hope because actually Canada does those small cities quite well. And it's figuring them out and it's testing and experimenting because the people who live there are fundamentally fantastic. Toronto is just a totally different beast, but it's playing at those different ends of the spectrum. It's really, really hard, but that's fascinating to me.
Yeah, I mean, each of these cities has a character. We don't, you know, in the case of Toronto, it's hard because there's multiple characters in Toronto and different dispositions by neighborhood. And I'm sure that Vancouver and Montreal and Calgary and Edmonton, they'd all say the same thing, that it's still pretty regionalized, even within the municipal boundary. But we are in this time of transition. And I love the challenge, the brief idea. I would love to think that we were about challenging the brief. I think the concern at the moment is that there's just a lot of complaining and curmudgeonliness.
There's an interesting thing of, like, I think Paris is a good example for that big city of Parisians like a good moan. But at the same time, they will moan about a restaurant, and this is a totally cliched way of putting it, but like, if you said to a Parisian, oh my God, the traffic here is so bad, they'd be like, well, you're an idiot for trying to drive into the center of Paris.
Correct. Correct.
They built a lot more transit and they still build it, but like, that's the situation. I feel Toronto, we've got into that situation of, it used to be like this, let's go back, versus how do we change it and go forward, because we're still trying to figure out who we really are.
You know, this is a fundamental challenge, though. Let's think about the economy and we'll think about the pressures and the sort of sense of doom that people are experiencing around a 25% tariff coming from the US. The thing about that is, if that impact hits, you know, it will impose an extraordinary constraint on the economy, but it can also incentivize remarkable innovation. I'm not saying bring it on, but if you take the city that you're adopting now, Montreal, 45 years ago, when the politics contributed to the large corporate corporate entities decamping from Montreal coming to Toronto, it incentivized, I mean, it was suffering at the time, I'm sure, but it incentivized the kind of generation of an extraordinarily resilient local economy in Montreal, which still exists even now. When you walk into Montreal streets and you don't see a lot of global chains, you see a lot of local businesses. So this is part of testing our resilience, I think. And I'm old enough to remember the discussions that have taken place in Canada at different times when NAFTA was first negotiated, and lots of folks who were questioning whether how closely we should tie ourselves to the American economy. And I'm familiar with some of the critique that some of the world's economists who advocated for globalization, people like Martin Wolf and others, who have come back and said, look, yay, we didn't quite anticipate a lot of the implications. And as you know, I'm a big localist, particularly around local economies. And that, when I see hand-wringing in Canada about the economy and productivity, and I even saw a lament from one of the most senior officials suggesting that Canada was a problem because it had such a small, such a significant SME sector. And I'm thinking, well, the SME sector actually employs a huge percentage of the population and might actually be one of our strengths. So I think it's a time of reckoning. Climate could have put the same kind of shock into the economy, but for whatever set of reasons, it's not seen in the way that the Trump proposed tariffs are. But these are both externally applied challenges that may really force a distilled conversation about what are we making, what are we producing, what are we retaining, what are we co-creating, how do we do that in environmentally and socially just ways, etc. So, and then you're back to place, and you're back to how do you wrap your arms around something that you can actually see or engage with, you know?
When it comes to the CUI, how does the CUI work? Like, we missed this in the introduction, so like, tell us a little bit about the Canadian Urban Institute, kind of what you do and what it exists for.
It was founded in 1990 by a former Metro councillor who, I mean, I remember when this happened. It was founded in City Hall when we still had a Metro government. And they initially, I think the gang that was around then felt that Toronto had done some really good things and that it could tell a story and advance ideas beyond Toronto and in other parts of Canada, but also other parts of the world, around urbanism. And so it quickly got lots of support from what was then the Canadian International Development Agency, CEDA, did a lot of international work, and it had some domestic focus, but a lot of it was international, driven internationally. And, you know, it was planners and architects and folks, former politicians or politicians sort of midway through one jurisdiction, getting ready to mount a campaign in another jurisdiction. We've had all of that there. And they, as I say, they built a strong network of built environment specialists who then had projects in Eastern Europe and different parts of Asia. But then over time, the international work was no longer fundable. And I came in at a time when I think the organization was trying to decide what would its next iteration be. And I said, let's put the Canadian back in the Canadian Urban Institute. Let's talk about connective tissue. Let's figure out how do we actually embrace the variations of urbanism that exists in French Canada and Western Canada, and there are times in the North. Yeah, so there we are. So we're a clearinghouse for research. We have academic partners across the country. We have practitioner partners also across the country. I've made a big emphasis on building partnerships, because we're never going to have a huge staff. We need to have folks that we can call on who have particular expertise. I wake up every morning reflecting on a vast geography with a relatively small population. And how do you actually come to terms with the challenges that we have, place-based challenges we have, which are equal to what American cities deal with, but with a tenth of the population to solve them? So very demanding, I would say. But we have highlighted, we've used as a sort of proxy for looking locally at two units, downtowns and main streets. And how do you use those as the hearts and spines of communities of every size? Every community in the country can tell you where their main street is. And it may be maybe a four corners. It may be a very long strip. It may be maybe iconic. You have a few of those in Montreal. We have several in Toronto. Vancouver has them. Every large cities have them, but even small communities do. And it might be the back of a strip mall. And so that level of granular analysis is important to us. And we've worked in partnership with a bunch of different folks to highlight that. And most recently, as you heard in Ottawa, we're making the case that Main Street's your infrastructure. So they should be invested in as a unit. So you know, infrastructure isn't just bridges and roads. It's actually this economic and social unit called the Main Street.
It's kind of interesting right now, though, is like all the social media types want to talk about being the town square.
Mm-hmm.
Facebook wanted that, Twitter wanted that, Elon Musk wanted that, and those places just can't be it. They've got so toxic. So it's almost like making people realize, hang on, where's the physical interaction? And we've neglected our Main Street, like you say. Like, I'm really lucky, like I've probably got 6 in walking distance of me from where I live in Montreal.
Yeah.
And I'm still not doing a good enough job of learning French. So, and I'm struggling to understand Quebec accents, but I'm working on it. But like, I'm really blessed to have that. And in Toronto, I didn't feel like I had that. Even though I lived in a nice neighborhood, I didn't really feel like I had that sort of space. There's other small towns that do this amazingly well, but I think that's like a massively important challenge, especially this year as we're trying to build a bit more cohesion when we're all angry at each other about politics.
Yeah, exactly. My sister, who doesn't live here, whenever she visits, she says to me, Mary, you don't live in a 15-minute neighborhood. You live in the 32nd neighborhood. Because literally everything is within a minute of where I am. But I'm almost downtown, and I'm in a fortunate situation. But as you suggest, the diversity, you know, you can have a neighborhood that might have a lot of amenities but isn't remotely diverse and is kind of dull as a result. And so, and not everybody needs to live in the same kind of neighborhood. That's the other thing, you know, people, that's what I always say, cities are about choice. And so if you want to own a car, you have the resources to do so, knock yourself out, own a car. Live in a part of the city where you're going to be in your car a lot. But there are lots of folks that are choosing to do that quite differently. So it's all about upping choice. And I think that's one of the challenges with the dominant narrative now, is that somehow we're in a housing crisis that can only be solved by creating more single family dwellings that are at ground. And we did a piece on, with support from CMHC, Canada Mortgage and Housing, about what are the housing opportunities along Main Streets? Because when a Main Street redevelops, which sometimes you want it to do, and they introduce more housing, they go from, you know, 2 stories to 6 stories with podium, but you lose all the affordable, because what used to be above the shop, like I live above a shop, and what used to be here is now me. Now, I'm in a 4-unit, and so we haven't displaced in the same way. There are ways to ensure that you get more housing choice along Main Streets. And we ran the numbers and we think you could get 3.5 million housing units if you intensified existing Main Streets. And it's good for climate, good for the economy, good for all sorts of reasons. So these are all complex questions, obviously. But I want to always be doubling down on the local, the local, the local.
Why is Canada often quite slow to pick things up? I think about this, there's a bit of The Simpsons where Bart moves and he gets put in a remedial class. And there's a kid in that class that's like, I'm from Canada because I'm slow, eh? There's like various references to Canada being behind the times, like How I Met Your Mother do this, of like the 80s didn't come to Canada until 93. But like, it feels like we know all the problems. And there's loads of people that like are far ahead, have been, lived in other places, traveled to other places, read about other places. But we still struggle to make the political decisions to advance things faster. I don't get why we're...
I am just so not a pundit. You know, during the pandemic, people were saying, oh, cities are dead. And they wanted to come out and say, yes, cities are dead. And I used to always say, oh my God, I'm just not that person. I learned to not be that person by being sharply rebuked by Jane Jacobs. Anytime you ever made any kind of, I didn't have that long an association with her. Lots of folks in our lives had 30 years with Jane. I didn't have that. I had 10. But I learned quickly enough that if you ever made the mistake of making some big broad generalization, even if you were just thinking out loud, you would get cast down on it so quick. You just learn not to do it. But because there would be some elaborate set of reasons of what you hadn't thought of or what you hadn't considered that needs to be part of your analysis. But I think I would say that it's by virtue of geography again. You know, in the United States, where I lived for a number of years, everything is denser. So, I mean, I wasn't in rural U.S., but I was, I mean, although I would go into the rural environments, but I lived in cities. And, you know, you're just on top of each other more. And then there are more cities. So there's more continuous learning. And also the workforce in the areas in which I would be working. So whether it's in philanthropy or community development or arts and culture or the built environment, there's much more mobility in terms of where people work. So they've done a stint in St. Louis, and then they moved to Santa Barbara, and then they went and did something in, you know, in Cincinnati, and then they went to New York. And here, that's not the case. People tend to make their careers any place and not move, at least in my generation, and not move. So they don't have the same diverse experience that you might have had if you came from different places. So I think some of it is just that. There's a caution. There's a kind of inherent conservatism to Canada. We, you know, we're one of the most urbanized countries in the world, largely because of immigration. So people have been catapulted into an urbanistic set of values, but there are lots of people that haven't, you know, and they still live in small communities, and they're still, and they have had the same haircut. I used to joke about this when I lived rural. You know, I didn't understand how do you actually get a contemporary haircut. It's a ridiculous, superficial thing to look at, but it is part of the question of how cultural norms get advanced. So I don't know. And the other thing, it kind of goes back to our earlier conversation about our dependency on the American economy. You know, we live in a hyper-connected environment where we have so much American media, and we have so much American product, and we have American markets, and it's a very privileged place to be. So have we had to hustle hard? Have we been in Europe, you know, being a country surrounded by a whole bunch of other competitive economies and had to figure out how the hell we're going to hold our own? So I don't, that's what I would wonder about. And maybe that's contributed to it, is that there's some caution about that. I also don't know whether we've invested, again, if we were, it's like we're in that weird middle space. If we were half our size, population-wise, would there have to be some kind of investment to say, holy shit, we're going to have to double down on post-secondary and research, because there's no way we're going to survive unless we become extraordinary at something. And the only way we're going to become extraordinary is if we throw a shit ton of money at it. Whereas we were that little bit bigger, and we didn't have to become that great at it. And, you know, I often think about those Nordic countries, and I think about the pressures they've been under to figure it out.
Uh-huh.
And maybe we just haven't had the same level of pressure. But wouldn't you love to think, Ian, that we would be the place that's going to have to figure out transition, energy transition, because we've derived so much of our wealth from oil and gas, and now we're going to have to be the ones that lead that. Don't you think we have to be the ones that figure out how you deal with severe weather swings, cold and warm, because we have both? You know, we have 35 cities that are riparian or either on a river or a lake or an ocean. And shouldn't we be the ones to be the best, the way that the Netherlands is, to be the best at waterfront redevelopment and all that kind of thing? I would love that. But I think that there's always been a difficulty arriving at a consensus about that. Well, there's tons of ambivalence about whether or not government should pick winners, et cetera, et cetera. And it's, I think, you know, that's where I revert back to. If you focus on connective tissue, if you focus on the enabling conditions, that people have agency, that they have opportunity, that you get the basic income right, da, da, da. And then see, just focus on the basic conditions, the enabling conditions that communities need, and then see what they come up with.
Yeah. I think the housing thing right now is the fascinating piece, because we're going to have an election. We're going to be very focused on build homes. It's one of the candidate slogans, rightly so, even though I don't like the guy. But I think that's like sort of brilliant, because we're going to have this thing of we're going to build a load of homes, but like what homes, where are they going to be? How are we going to think about the schools, the hospitals, the transportation, all the other infrastructure that sits around it?
Yeah.
And then hopefully we get to this place where it's back to being messy again.
Yeah.
Where it's there's loads of different ways of skinning a cat. And we can do it in various different ways. And if you're doing it in St. John, New Brunswick, or if you're doing it in Toronto, or if you're doing it in Vancouver, all your waterfronts look completely different. So you may as well do different things with them.
Yeah.
And then other places might go, well, I want to steal that bit. I want to steal that bit. That's a really interesting practice. Oh, God, no, we'll not do that again. That was a disaster. That's a great place to be.
I mean, again, you know, if you go back to, we were able to rely on natural resources for so long. Even when I hear them talking now about critical minerals, so we've got to be strategic about this. How do we make ourselves matter more to the U.S.? There's a whole round of really smart folks. You heard it at the summit, Public Policy Forum, the Monk folks. They're thinking really thoughtfully about this. How do you make Canada matter more in the U.S. economy? And critical minerals is a great part of it. But part of me, my heart sinks, and I think, oh, for God's sake, like, can we not carve out some other niches that are not dependent on depleting a resource in the ground? And that's why I want to invest in people and in places and in culture and in things that are regenerative. Technology can be regenerative. what are the new opportunities that can be extracted from that. So you can extract from technology in a really positive, generative way, not in a depleting, extractive way.
Where have you been? Where have you looked at where you've gone, my God, that's made me so jealous. I want something like that here. Or maybe not even just lifting and dropping, but that's the thing that's really inspired you and given you the energy. Like, where do you, cities big and small, where have you looked at?
I love markets. I love the dynamism of public markets and what can be incubated there. And communities across the country can take old spaces, and in some cases, they've taken an old fairgrounds, or they've taken an old industrial space, or they've taken some kind of an armory or something. And then they just basically open it up, create stalls, and then see what happens. And this happens again and again and again, where you go into one of these and you see, oh, there's a sister team that are making beautiful, you know, made-to-order cakes, and you're just kind of mind-boggled at how beautiful they are. And sure enough, they've got a community kitchen where they can be able to operate from. So I'm fascinated with how we use space for commercial opportunity. And in terms of public space, you know, I want us to always be adding where we can more diversity into a public space use, so that it's not just a beautiful park. It's actually also a beautiful market. Oh, it's also got some vending. It's got some commercial opportunity. It's got some living space. So I am interested in those kinds of spaces. And I'm generally more fond of ones that are in older buildings where there's some kind of random kind of underutilized space. So it's more affordable and you can just try some stuff. And then the barrier of entry is quite modest. You know, it's just basically a table and up you go. And I was at a fair, one of those Christmas fairs before Christmas. And again, old space, old industrial space, pop up, I think. Maybe they've been there before. And, you know, there was everybody there from, as I just suggested, the sister team from Scarborough that were making really beautiful handmade stuff. And there was a potter there who I know who also makes cakes. He was there. And then there was an older woman standing behind a counter, behind a desk, and it was all books about women and women in Canadian politics and women in Canadian life and women in the church. And I started crying to her because they're all her books. She's written them all. And she's older than me. And, you know, she only takes cash. Thanks. And I just thought, you know, this kind of, you know, that old adage, if you build it, they will come. Like, there's something about providing this kind of opportunity for purveying. You look at the stacked market in Toronto that Matt Rutkoff has done. It's just it's a pop-up space that's now more permanent of where he used containers and the spaces are small and he creates opportunities for large businesses to grow out of a very small, modest thing. And now he's doing it with sporting, you know, he's taking vacant lots and turning them into pickleball and padel courts. And I love that. I love the resourceful way that we can take space in different kinds of ways to provide economic and social opportunity.
And I like how you picked Canadian examples. You didn't go off and say, oh, here's the thing I've seen in Copenhagen or Amsterdam or Seville or something.
Well, they have them too. You know, I remember in New Orleans, as you know, a lot of my experience around resilience was incubated, or I learned the hard way in New Orleans, going in with all the wrong assumptions and having those drummed out of me. And I remember one of the local activists said to me, when they were doing planning for commercial corridors and stuff, and, you know, the planners were coming in saying, well, we need to have opportunities for small businesses to locate here, retail. She turned to me and she said, you know, we don't really create selling opportunities in New Orleans. We vend. I remember thinking, okay, right. We're like a vendor culture. So you go, like a market culture, you go in and there's a vendor there 1 week. You might be a different vendor in the next week. So yeah, really basic kinds of things like that. And to me, the synergy of craft, commercial activity, there's a transaction, I'm paying for it. Place, engagement, I'm there yakking to the person. Who knows what's going to happen while I'm standing there, creating a sense of sort of place and a vibe and all that kind of stuff. I mean, you know, honestly, it's not rocket science. I'm not that smart. I'm just an observer, and we all know what we like. You know, people like this stuff.
Like, it makes me think of when I lived in, like, worked near Euston and King's Cross stations in London.
Yeah.
And then there was a huge redevelopment at King's Cross. It was years, and it was still a decade away from really being a proper thing at that point.
Yeah.
All the building work's happening. And they just started doing food markets.
Yeah.
When here we can have some food vendors, people will come along, they'll see the progress of the development over time. But it sort of brought people into giant amounts of cranes, loads of dump trucks, like shipping out stuff, loads of construction going on, loads of noise, loads of disruption.
Yeah.
Ugly. But it brought people into the development locally as it was happening. And I think like it's those kinds of things that really do sort of like challenge the convention of here's the perfect project plan. And I think like I just like the last one of these we did was with someone from Northcrest doing Downsview.
Chris.
Yeah, with Chris. And I don't particularly love the idea of Rogers Stadium, but like I think that's a great thing that they're doing to like Toronto needs bigger gigs, needs bigger like cultural opportunities. Having that pop-up stadium then brings people into the Downsview development like while they're building it. So to me that's another example. But like yeah, that sort of culture of setting those things up, seeing what happens and then going from there does make great places. I want to ask the question that I always ask people as we come towards the end of these things, which is if you had a magic wand to do something that would help create better Challenger cities, what would you do with your magic wand? What would your wish or your command be?
I really, during the pandemic, I thought we had an opportunity to reaffirm the importance of mutual aid. And we have a long history in Canada of mutual aid and of trying to institutionalize mutual aid. And I mean, insurance is mutual aid. We have a long, you know, we have co-ops and we have lots of historical examples that were founded on the principle of mutual aid. And we're those institutions that have supported mutual aid, faith institutions, principally, for instance, are closing. And I think it's going to be a little of our Joni Mitchell moment, you know, where you're not going to realize what you had till it's gone, because there's so much that goes on in the fabric of those buildings that may have initially started with some kind of a religious purpose, but has long since become much more of a civic benefit. But the people that were perpetuating it and funding it are old and not going to church anymore. So I think that I saw it during the pandemic when there was so much self-organizing going on and people couldn't wait for anybody. Nobody spent 10 seconds wondering whose jurisdiction it was. We got to figure out a way to get portable washrooms in those parks. How are we going to do it? You know? And it became this kind of, I used to joke that the pandemic put us into this massive kind of DIY place. Like everybody, we were all a pilot. So I'd love to see us rekindle that kind of resourcefulness in a decentralized way, because that's how innovation happens. That's how smart ideas get incubated. A couple of smarty pants sit around the kitchen table and say, why don't we try it this way? And why don't we do that? And I love that notion of cognitive surplus, which I'm sure you're familiar with, which is now in the tech world that, you know, you and I could put a problem out at 5 o'clock this afternoon, something that used to would have taken us and McKinsey 19 weeks to do, and we can put it out into the Ethernet and, you know, three geeks are going to figure it out by 7 a.m. Like we have the non-tech versions of that. We have lots of folks who are extraordinarily resourceful and just need the architecture of participation to be invited in, put their mind to it and put their muscle to it. And so I would love, if I had a magic wand, I think I would find ways to really support decentralization and incentivizing local solutions, local experimentation, and strengthening mutual aid. And I don't have an answer for how we do that when it's not reinforced by societal structures like faith communities. Or so the secular version of that would be to double down on community centers and libraries and other civic institutions, other third places, the coffee shops. And if we could find ways to reinforce the benefit and the value of that, that would be my magic wand. Boy, not that easy, huh?
Hey, we can make a start. And I think one way to make a start, and that is like with the CUI, if someone's listened to this and gone, oh my God, this is so cool, Mary's awesome, kind of drunk the Kool-Aid like I did, how can they help? How can they get involved with what you're up to?
Yeah. Well, one thing they can do is visit canherb.org and have a look, and then just basically go out their front door and start paying attention to what they're seeing and pay attention to what is going on where we need those kinds of really imaginative collective responses. Here's one that I think we all can start thinking about. I think Main Street retail is critical to community cohesion. And that means to stop buying online and to start doing all sorts of things. But the only way that will happen, you can't just, you know, scold people into it. So I think we need different kinds of storefronts, different kinds of vendors coming into storefronts. So not just one store, but maybe there are 8 vendors in there, different kinds of hours, different kinds of uses, different kinds of, why aren't we co-locating restaurants and coffee shops with bookstores, with health clinics? Why aren't we providing medical clinics in the drugstores? I mean, all this is starting to happen. And I think that we're going to see more and more of this multiple use, multiple kinds of benefits that accrue to you when you walk into a place, into a retail experience, something, and you can get a whole lot that is available to you in that space. So I think the more we double down on that and create real viable economic activity in those kinds of cultural locations.
I love that. Mary, then you got to go.
Thanks okay.
So much for this. This has been amazing. We may have to get you back.
Okay.
But yeah.
I'm delighted. I look forward to how you edit this to make sense. Good to talk to you.
Thank you so much for getting to this point. You listened to another Challenger Cities podcast. What we need from here is, if you can subscribe, like, share, do all the usual things that people say at the end of podcasts to try and grow the reach and turn it into something. What I really want to do in 2025 is find ways that we can make cities better, more fun, joyful, productive, healthy, happy places. Lots of people are trying to do this. Lots of people are doing good things, but I think it's a messy place where we need to try out more things and experiment more, kind of as we've alluded to in that conversation with Mary just now. So if you know folks that are looking to change the world, if you know companies that should be doing better, if you know civic leaders who are trying to find new ways of playing around and experimenting, much of what I do is helping discover the future, find ways to create and test it, prototype it, and let's go apply that to cities. So yeah, here we go. Here's the sort of shameless plug. I do this with a business called Now or Never. You can find more about that at nowornever.network. And there we go. We'll be back with more of these very, very soon. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.